On this episode of the Tough Juice Podcast, I had the pleasure and honor with sitting down with NFL great Hall of Famer Terrell Owens. And we talked about a lot of things. We talked about Tyreek Hill, his raise. Somebody owed him a little money on our staff. I'm not going to say no names, Mike. Also, ownership in the NFL. We also talked about the Black Lives Matter movement and some of the things that could continue to happen in the midst of everything that's happening from the social injustice standpoint. And also Pat Mahomes, I think that he's really changed the game, and you're going to be very, very intrigued by, you know, the comment that Terrell Owens made about that and how he's universally changed that position. And also, what is Cam Newton going to do with the Patriots? He said, do not press, but now I'm not going to tell you the rest of it. You have to tune in to the Tough Juice Podcast on the Himalaya app or wherever you get your pods. So, T.O., you got to tell me, bro, now that we got action, because I want this story to be heard. You know, you're talking about Tyreek Hill and this 100-yard dash, bro. What exactly happened?
So, on my podcast, Get Your Popcorn Ready with myself and Hatch, we had him on a few weeks ago. And prior to that, I think, or maybe a week or two before he came on, or a week before, we had the Olympic sprinter champion Justin Gatlin on. So we were talking about a little bit of that, and so we got into speed and things of that nature, and him being one of the fastest in the league. And so I said something like, I'll give him a run for his money. And so he was like, man, you crazy. He was like, man, I'll give you 10 steps. He goes, I'm like, 10 steps and beat me in 100? I said, no way. He goes, no, I'm not saying 10 yards. He said, 10 steps. So I'm like, all right, cool. I said, bro, trust me, I'll take that bet. And so Hatch, my co-host on Get Your Popcorn Ready podcast, he basically co-signed with Tyreek and basically said he would beat me as well. And I'm like, Hatch, I'm like, how disrespectful is that, that you're just going to jump ship and think that he's going to give me 10 steps? And the thing is, Hatch, he's my co-host. I think he's a year younger than me, but he's probably like body-wise, he's probably like 85, 86. You know what I mean? But I don't know why he wants to kind of put us in the same grouping that we can do the same things. But as I said, and we were talking before we got on here, I'm built a little bit different than a lot of guys. When you talk about some of the greatest athletes in all of sports, you know, I think of guys like Deion Sanders, Bo Jackson, some of the greats that have played basketball. You think about MJ, you talk about Kobe, let's talk about what LeBron is doing right now in year 17. We're guys that are just built differently. And I think I put myself in that category, like I said, probably like most underrated, probably one of the greatest, probably like athletes probably ever that don't really get talked about because of, like I said, I didn't probably play a two sport, or I didn't get the recognition, or I wasn't really a four or five star kid coming out of high school or coming out of college. So I didn't have all this pizzazz and all the speed and all the physical attributes, what makes up a dynamic football player like a Tyreek Hill, which, I mean, he possesses a lot of like Olympic speed. So I didn't have all those attributes when I first came into the league, but I progressively got better with my training, this, that, and the other. So I'm just as fast, and I got faster as my seasons and as I got older in my career, which is kind of odd, but those are some of the things that I worked on because I wanted to be the best that, number one, that I could be. And then I had a guy, Jerry Rice, that was like, for a number of you basketball players, that, you know, you had these guys that set the barometer for basketball players. You talk about MJ, you talk about Kobe, you talk about, you know, Magic Johnson, you talk about Bill Russell. These are sort of like the top basketball pioneer guys that kind of paved the way for you guys. So that's what Jerry, you know, sort of like a physical, just something different that nobody has ever really seen.
So you basically saying when God made you, he pretty much just threw away the mold there. That's basically what you're saying.
Yeah, dog. He put his hands on me, dog. You know, he put his hands on me, dog. And, you know, voila, you know, this is at 46, bro, trust me. I'm not really surprised at what I can do. Even when I stopped playing, like I could have continued to play. I should have continued to play at least 3, 4, 5 years. But as what we're dealing with as the world, when we talk about systemic racism, and I know we're kind of getting off topic a little bit, that was kind of what happened with me. A lot of politics that went into it, because there was no reason why I couldn't have, and I shouldn't have played 3 to 4 or 5 more years, because it wasn't performance based. When I got cut from the Cowboys, there's a form that the organizations, I think the owner has to fill out or what have you, and there's a bunch of boxes that are checked in, you know, as to why that individual is being released from that team. And so regardless and despite whatever the speculation is about, you know, why I left Dallas, why I left, you know, San Fran, why I left Philadelphia, everybody wants to say it was about locker room, this, that, and the other. Let's talk about when I left Dallas. That was one of the boxes they checked, was performance. It was based on my performance as why they let me go. And obviously, you look at my stats, that was clearly not the case. But it is what it is. Could I play today right now? Absolutely. Could I play 65, 75 snaps? No. You know, as a veteran, you're not going to be able to go in. Like, if you were to go try to play right now, you're not going to be able to play starter minutes. You know what I mean? You're going to pick, your coach is going to know what you do best, put you in certain situations. You know what I mean? That's the same situation that I would welcome if given the opportunity. Third down situations, you talk about red zone, that's where I would be valuable.
That's crazy you say that, because I want to get into the systemic racism and all of that conversation, because that's a must with the climate that we're living in right now. But you stated you actually got faster as you got older. And people don't understand, I got to put this out here. You actually had a surgery in March?
No, I had a surgery. My surgery was in December. So okay. I'm right at December 16th, I had surgery. I'm right outside of 7.5 months.
And still running like this?
Yep. And that just factors into really kind of what I became as I started out as a rookie to my last 15th year. And now, you know, a Hall of Famer, that's really kind of what embodied my career. It's my 3 D's, I call them. It's desire, dedication, and discipline. Everybody, again, on your podcast, on my podcast, everybody in this world has a desire to be or do something in life. But in order to, whatever your goal is, in order to reach your goal and beyond, those other 2 D's has to complement your desire. And that's dedication and discipline. Player of all time and Kobe Bryant. When you talk about what separated him from the rest, him using Michael Jordan as a blueprint, it doesn't get any better than that. When you talk about the Mamba mentality, that's what's been thrown around because of he's coined that phrase. I think I possessed a little bit of that. I didn't have whatever it was, my mentality. It wasn't Mamba at that time. We call it T.O. mentality. But that was what I possessed, is because I knew that I wasn't as good as my peers. Even when I was in high school and college, and I realized that I was a late bloomer. There was a lot of things, a lot of fine tuning that I had to do to my game in order to get to the elite level of some of the greats and be spoken of with in the same breath as some of the greats that ever played the game of football. So that's what, when I reflected back on my career, those 3 D's are what allowed me to be sitting right here on this show with you, on your show, you know, as a Hall of Famer.
Man, that's amazing. And congrats on that Hall of Fame nod. I felt like you was the first ballot. So, you know, I'm extremely happy for you for that. And when you talk about some of the all-time greats, now you're the measuring stick for a lot of other guys out there. But who was the measuring stick for you? And then where did you place yourself, like, in NFL history as the top wide receivers ever to play the game of basketball? Where do you place yourself?
In the game of football, yeah, I mean – personally, when I came out of college, I was really raw green. There was a lot of, like I said, there was a lot of fine tuning. There was a lot that I needed to add to my game. So I was, like I said, really raw, looked at, drafted, as having, you know, a lot of potential. When you talk about the physical attributes of a receiver, especially around that time, I got drafted in 96. When you think about the mold of receivers at that time, they were 6 foot and above. You think about the Jerry Rice's, the J.J. Stokes, the Herman Moores, the Jake Reeds. These were guys, Michael Irvins. These were guys that were obviously big in stature, the physical attributes, and we talk about speed and things of those nature, that nature, that's what I lacked. A lot of the footwork that I needed to get off bump and run, just the knowledge of the game. That was a lot to my game that you know, if they're, you know, because there's always been this conversation in between, and these guys, myself, it's either Jerry, myself, and Randy, or Jerry, Randy, me. Those are the top three names that come to mind. We talk about some of the top receivers to ever play the game. And so for me, I consider myself a complete receiver. You talk about a receiver that learned how to really catch the ball, do a lot of great things with and without the ball. I embodied, you know, being able to, and I took pride at being able to running every route in the route tree, being fearless going over the middle, really understanding that, you know, there's 10 other guys that are depending on me when there's a run play, when the play is coming to me, and when it's going away from me. So when you talk about the totality, the entirety of a receiver, it's just not only just catching the ball. It's just like if you try to assess a basketball player, you know what a basketball player you're scouting or you're game planning. You know if this guy is just a shooter, if he's going to be lazy on defense or what have you. I wanted to be one of those receivers that had no weaknesses. And so I worked on those things from my rookie year, probably like after through my rookie year, I really kind of all the way to my 15th year. Every coach that I had, I asked them and I told them, I said, don't stop coaching me. Even though I knew the things that I was establishing, the receiver that I was becoming, I didn't want to be complacent. I didn't want to feel like I had arrived. I steadily wanted to get better. So Jerry was always that guy that was the barometer for me. And then I realized I couldn't be Jerry. We were two different type of receivers. Our body makeup was a lot different. You know, I was a big physical type receiver. He's a smaller frame. He was more of a finesse guy, but he played tough. But I realized I could take a little bit of what Jerry brought to his game, to my game, and add it. And like I said, it only added to my capabilities and abilities to do what I did on the football field. And everything else, it was a lot of hard work, bro. Trust me. When I tell you those three D's are what enabled me to do the things that I did on the field, like I said, my desire, dedication, and discipline. And it wasn't just the physical stuff, too. It was me maintaining my body, the body maintenance, the nutrition. When you talk about Kobe, he talked about all those things because he taxed out his body. When he played, when he practiced, he left it all on the floor. And his training was a big part of it in the offseason. What enabled him to do what everybody saw on a nightly basis. And then he had that mentality. He had that killer instinct. That's how I was when I played. I was kind of old school, bro. I didn't believe in, like, you know, fraternizing before the game, dabbing up. Bro, trust me. I was so focused, bro. I was ready to play. I was ready to kill.
And I love the fact that you continue to bring up, you know, the late, great Kobe Bryant, my brother, you know, someone that I spent countless hours with, and he was a mentor of mine and had a great connection and relationship with, you know, God rest his soul. But the one thing that I realized about Kobe after the fact that he was done playing the game of basketball, he was extremely, like, welcoming to, like, some of the young guys that wanted to be the best version of them. When you talk about the 3 D's and all that stuff. So are you extremely welcoming, or are you super competitive still to the point, like, no, like, I'm still trying to show that I'm still the best to do it?
No, I'm always, bro, I'm always accessible. If guys want that knowledge, then that tells me a lot about that individual and what they're trying to accomplish. You know, a lot of guys, again, they're maybe too prideful to ask for help. That was for me, that was one thing that I wasn't. Like I said, I knew that I wasn't the best. And so even now, bro, like, I realize for somebody that grew up in a small town, went to a relatively small school, in high school, went to a relatively small college at UT Chattanooga, bro, I realized that I wasn't always the best. You know what I mean? So if somebody wants to pick my brain or, you know, chop it up, you know, to better themselves, bro, I'm always accessible. I'm always welcome. Cause I, at the end of the day, we all, like I said, if you're trying to get to the top and be the best, then you don't know everything, you know? And so for me, I'm always going to be open to share that knowledge to someone else. in order to make them great. You know, like I said, in my eyes, I wasn't afraid to be great. And if that entailed, you know, studying more, if that entailed asking a lot more questions, if that entailed, you know, me, you know, being more observant with everything that was surrounding me as far as the resources to be a better player, then that's what I did. I made the most of those opportunities. And so I welcome any guys, you know, if you want to be the best, then don't feel like, you know, you see a superstar or your idol or what have you, don't feel like they're going to shun you away or not going to be as welcoming as some. You know, some guys are, some aren't. But I think it just tells you a lot about Kobe based on where he was in his career versus his post-career. And that just showed you his mentality. He really, like I said, that was his livelihood. So he put everything into making him the best version, really kind of Michael Jordan. And he made him the best version of himself. Like I said, he was probably the closest living clone we will ever see to Michael Jordan.
I totally agree with that. And, you know, to pivot into another space, man, when you talk about the climate and our observation of what we're dealing with in the society right now, first we have, you know, COVID. 2020 hasn't been kind to us. And then you see the, you know, police brutality across the globe, you know, happening specifically here in America. What was your thoughts initially when you saw, you know, the killing of George Floyd?
Bro, I remember exactly where I was when I saw the video. It was a day after it had happened. It happened on a Monday. I saw the video on a Tuesday. Just, you know, obviously with COVID, as you mentioned, pretty much everything was shut down. So I was actually just pulled over and I was about to get a bite to eat. And so I was just waiting on my order. So as I was waiting, I just kind of just was strolling through my Instagram, and my boy had sent me the video. And bro, I didn't even look at the entirety of the video. I kind of just skimmed through and just went all the way back to toward the end of the video. And I saw how they killed the dude. And bro, immediately I just had just a rush of emotion that came through me. Instantly, bro, I instantly, Karan, I thought about my brother. I thought about my son. I thought about my nephew. I thought about like some of my close friends. I put them in George Floyd's shoes. Like that could have been them. And so then I started to think further, man, you know, outside of that, I'm like, man, I have kids, I have daughters, you know what I mean? This is the world they're living in right now. And so it just hit me like a ton of bricks, bro. I was so emotional, and I had never been that emotional for somebody, like I said, I had never met, and just watching this live. And I think it touched and affected a lot of people differently because with COVID and the shutdown of where we were as a country at that time, everybody witnessed this for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, bro. And it was hard to watch. It was a tough pill to swallow. And man, it allowed me really to really just allow me to be more of a parent, be more aware of what's going on, you know, in our country, in our Black communities. And I've been able to now just use my voice to try to, you know, bridge the gap or just try to be a voice for the very thing that Colin knelt for 4 years ago that fell on deaf ears. And so it has come full circle. The very thing that he preached then that fell on deaf ears. And now the world got to see it firsthand. And I think it really took the world by storm literally 8 minutes and 46 seconds. They saw a Black man die in slow death by a white man. And three other officers that assisted and aided and abetted in the criminal activity. And this isn't something new that we as Black people are experiencing. We've been experiencing this for years and years and years, and it hasn't gotten better, but there's movement. There has been some progress, and that there's a lot more progress that needs to be made. But there's, you know, this hurt right here, bro. Like this hurt me like no other. And I've experienced a lot of death in my life, from loved ones, close people, family members. But this, man, just to see the manner in which George Floyd died, man, it was tough to watch.
Bro, I echo everything that you said. When you talk about putting myself in that situation, putting a loved one in that situation, and you know the emotions that I had felt, and I wanted to make an educated evaluation, but for the first time in a long time, I reacted on emotion, and you know it was raw and it was authentic, and I think that everyone felt it from all walks of life, whether you was black, white, whatever. You saw that this was a universal wrong. And my next question to you would be, have you ever experienced racism? I know that's a crazy question, but I know you probably have, because I have in numerous cases, you know, whether it's systemic racism or this blatant racism. Have you ever experienced racism?
Yes, I've experienced it firsthand, and I've been part of systematic racism. A systemic racism. I know I mentioned probably about a month or so ago, I talked to TMZ and spoke to them about it. They asked me a similar question, and I mentioned that I experienced a little bit of that with the 49ers, and I did make sure to call and reach out to the owner, you know, that it had nothing to do with the present ownership of the 49ers at this present time. But, you know, I had a coach in Mariucci. I experienced the systemic racism with some of the things that transpired in that locker room, you know, based on how he treated me versus how he treated some other white players. And so, again, going back to my hometown, Alexander City, Alabama, obviously, like I said, I'm minutes away. I'm south of Birmingham. I'm north of Montgomery. So you talk about those two cities, those are some still, yeah, right. So I experienced a little bit, you know, probably, I think it might have been like my second or third year in the league or what have you, just being at a local diner in my hometown. And there was a gentleman in this diner. He has a little kid. The kid had to be like, you know, probably maybe about 4 or 5. And they were exiting the restaurant. And I was sitting at the counter bar. And so, like I said, everybody knew who I was at this time. Like I said, being from a small town, being drafted to the San Francisco 49ers, that's big news. It was big time. And so this guy saw me at the counter. They were getting ready to leave. And so he basically was talking to his son and explaining to his son, you know, basically trying to educate him on who I was, from the same town, went to Benjamin Russell High School. And he was like, yeah, this guy plays for the San Francisco 49ers, the NFL team. And so the little boy looked up to him. He goes, who? He's a who? That nigger right there? And so that was, like I said, I was taken back. I didn't really know how to react at that time. I didn't, I heard it, didn't know how to respond to it, didn't get mad at the kid because I couldn't fault that kid because that kid doesn't know any better. That kid obviously is a product of his environment. Obviously, he's heard this, you know, from either his dad, mom, or his surroundings. But yeah, that was like my first experience with that. But, you know, like I said, there's been a number of other encounters. But being raised by a strong black woman and my grandmother, her having to, you know, live through the days of segregation, her parents living through days of slavery. She did much as she could to educate us as we grew up. And so I was strong enough to withstand some of the things that I experienced. And so I could have brought those things to light, but I knew at that time, and even just going through some of the personal things that I did during the course of my career, again, I got a documentary coming out that I'll be working on here pretty soon. I will, you know, be shedding light on some of those encounters. But yeah, man, it's obvious. It's something that has to change. I think we as black people, the black community, obviously we're doing a job. We're now having to really kind of really re-educate ourselves and educate, coach and teach our kids, you know, especially if you got kids or teenagers that are on the cusp of driving and, you know that they maybe have some encounters with law enforcement, how to respond, how to act in those moments. I think the way we will be able to pivot and shift as a country is that just as we as a black community are teaching and educating our kids, the white people have to do the same thing with their kids. and teach them about race and diversity and loving others of other people of color. And I think that's where it'll start to shift. And it's already starting to shift, especially when you talk about the Generation Z kids. Those are kids from, you know, 96 to 2010. You see just the support and the allies, people outside of the, you know, brown and black people that have come in support of Black Lives Matter. And again, all lives matter. And we, and again, I think there's been so much talk about, you know, like there's a competition of all lives matter and Black Lives Matter. We're not saying that all lives don't matter, but at this point in time, we're focusing right now on what's being damaged the most, and that's the Black lives.
Man, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I am hopeful, and I want to ask you this. Are you hopeful? Because right now, across all states, all 50 states, we've seen marching, but something's been different in all the marches prior to this. We've seen three, possibly four generations out there. As you said, the Generation Z kids, you know, from the age of, you know, the 90s babies all the way up to, you know, the upper 25 to 30 year old kids that's super engaged in politics, on the front line, and, you know, actually informed on what they're talking about. So my question to you would be like the change that we're starting to see, me and you, people that look like you and I always had this discussion and conversation. But now these private institutions like the National Basketball Association, like the NFL, who I see Colin on your shirt or your sweater right now, they haven't been engaged in that conversation, but it seems like they're engaged now. What does that mean to you?
There's progress. I think, you know, that's a start. You know, you got to start somewhere. It's for me, I look at what Steven Jackson is doing. Again, he's not doing it alone. Like I said, he's one individual. Obviously he's been part of the NBA family. And he's one person that has really been at the forefront, you know, from the NBA family that's consistently out there. And again, it just starts with one person, and it's going to start with, then it's going to be two, and it's going to be three. As you see with some of these sports entities that you mentioned, you talk about the NFL, basketball, you talk about soccer, NASCAR, that's how the momentum is going to start. And again, you saw, you know, some of the changes that are being made. Look at NASCAR, they're taking away the Confederate flag. These are the signs of progress. And again, there's a lot of progress to be made. And again, I'm not going to be naive to think that, okay, just because they do this, maybe it's a PR thing or what have you. But just the fact that the initiative was made, you know, the approach in which they're trying to handle, you know, what we're dealing with as a country shows that people are, they're open-minded. They're starting to see the bigger picture. They're starting to kind of see the world through what we've been looking through our dark skin, our eyes for so many years. And so I'm very optimistic. I'm always going to try to see the glass half full more than anything. But like I said, we've made some progress. I think the ball is rolling, but there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And you can only commend, you know, the people that are in the positions of power. When you talk about, you know, like I said, you know, everybody has their opinion on Roger Goodell and his stance, and whether it's genuine out of them words. And so I think time will tell if all this work will be in vain or not.
When you look at ownership in the NFL, what are some of the things you want to see from them in that capacity?
Just some diversity. Obviously, like I said, we have no Black owners. When you talk about diversity, that needs to be the hiring of Black coaches, Black people throughout the NFL. From the top down. And I think that's what guys, especially Malcolm Jenkins, I think that's his message. That's their initiative, is to push that message of the hiring of Black coaches and Black people throughout the NFL in its entirety. And that's in concession stands, that's at stadiums, coaches, all across the board. I think we have, I don't know, I think maybe two or three Black coaches right now. I think out of the 32 teams. But yeah, I mean, the Rooney Rule is there in place, but it's just there, you know, just as sort of like a placeholder. We understand, like I said, for me, that's politics. They know, yeah, they can basically kind of just have it sit there. When a vacancy, job vacancy comes up for a head coaching job, what have you, a lot of these owners, they know that they're not going to hire a black coach, but then they want to bring, you know, bring a black coach in just to say, oh, okay, yeah, we brought him in. He didn't qualify. He didn't, you know, fit what we were looking for. But did you really ideally give them a fair opportunity? And, you know, you think about the Giants job that just got, what's his name? This guy named Joe Judge. I mean, he was a receiver coach. Do you not think that there are more qualified coaches that could have secured that head coaching position? Of course. Not only just as a white man, but even just being qualified in general. But you think about the black coaches that have been offensive coordinators, defensive coordinators that possibly could have secured that job. But for whatever reason, as we all know, like I said, it's part of the problem, the systemic racism that we're still fighting for. We're still fighting that fight. So it's a never ending battle. But like I said, we have the ball rolling. The conversations are starting to be had. And there's been some movements.
Through your lens, I don't understand this inclusion. My last few questions for you. When I look at the inclusion of Jay-Z on, I don't know if he's on a particular board or whatever the case may be, just from your position, like, what do that do? Like, adding someone like him with his observation on how he see things and having someone with his awareness in a room to make, probably help persuade some decisions, or like, what is his position in your eyes?
I mean, I honestly don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what value he has brought to any change as far as any initiatives or any conversations, anything impactful that the NFL has brought up. I honestly don't know. I don't know what that move was for. I'm sure he may be able to answer that better than anybody else. But as it stands right now, like, yeah, he was brought in, but what was his positioning? What was he brought in for? Yeah. What has he done since they brought him on board? I can't call it. I don't know what to say. I haven't seen anything as of lately, even through this whole pandemic, this whole situation. I haven't seen Jay-Z at the forefront of anything. Since, you know, last time I saw him, he was on TV, you know, in a room with Roger Goodell and some of the people talking about, I don't know what role that he serves and to what capacity that they brought him on board for. So I'm clueless. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer for you. But yeah, it that's the big question, and it remains to be seen as to what value is he bringing. Again, as a man of color, obviously a man in touch with our culture, obviously a man I feel like that can move the needle for us, but only I think Jay-Z can answer, you know, what he's done since I guess they brought him on board, and to what is the game plan with him on board on top of that.
Yeah, I agree. Like, what is the mission? And we have yet to see that, but you know, knowing Jay, is going to be something big at some point,
right?
Yeah, at some point. But if you're an owner in this position, you're building a franchise, mm-hmm. Who is your guy you start with?
You just by position or just individual? Or
I'm just saying, just, you got one pick. I don't know who you starting with.
I mean, right now, I would have to go with the guy that won the Super Bowl. That's I mean, he's the first quarterback before the age of 25 to win a Super Bowl and MVP. Obviously, he's equivalent to a point guard on the team that kind of runs the show. That's Patrick Mahomes. You know, you think about it. I mean, you have to build your team around a guy like that that has the ability to make all the throws. I would say he's a gunslinger, but he's a baller. He's a gamer. He's one of those players that you watch and you say he has that it factor. To do what he did in the playoffs and pretty much all the playoff games, to come from double-digit deficits and come back and win playoff games and then ultimately win the Super Bowl, that's a guy you want on your team. If you're starting an organization, that's a guy you want to start with.
So does that changes everything for black quarterbacks in the game, signing that extension? You know, is he the guy that's going to really move the needle going forward for black quarterbacks?
You would have to believe so. And you think about the black quarterbacks that are in this league now. You talk about your Dak Prescott's, the Lamar Jackson's, the Russell Wilson's, Jameis Winston's, your Teddy Bridgewater's. These are guys, like I said, again, Patrick Mahomes has set the bar, what black quarterbacks can become. Everybody's going to evaluate his contract versus everybody else's. What value do they bring to the team? Just as Lamar Jackson put on a show all the way throughout the course of the season last year and this year, they were kind of the favorites to win the Super Bowl. But again, these are guys like that have to they have to get away from those stereotypes of what a black quarterback is supposed to be and do back there at the quarterback position and play and do what they do best. And I think that's what some of these coaches, GMs are now really they're adopting is the ability of some of these black quarterbacks and really orchestrating and their offenses and their team around the ability of their quarterbacks. So if your guy can run, in certain instances, certain cases, he's going to run. You have to live and die by that. But then what I've seen is a lot of these black quarterbacks, they've taken it upon themselves to take it personal, of the stereotype or the stigma that, black quarterbacks can do is run. They're taking upon themselves to be able to read defenses, dissect defenses, with their eyes, with their arms, being able to do what they do best when plays break down, something that a lot of white quarterbacks can't do. When plays break down, that's that athletic ability. That's that extra gift of black quarterbacks that some of these white quarterbacks don't have is escapability. Being mobile, agile, the plays break down. Instead of it being, third and long or whatever, you don't get that. These guys can pick up the down and distance with their feet.
Well, speaking of picking up the down and distance with their feet, we got a quarterback on the scene that's at a new location in Cam Newton. What do you think his ceiling going to be? Or, what's the expectations of the Patriots with Cam Newton leading the way?
Man, this is a dude. Bro, I love this guy. I love his energy. I love his mindset. He's a man on a mission. So, yeah, when you talk about Cam Newton, this is a guy, honestly, I love his energy. I love his mentality. I love his mindset right now. Again, it's one of those things. He's a man on a mission. I'm hoping that he just allows the game to just come to him. I don't want him to be so pressed to go out and try to show the world what he can do in one game or what have you. One game is not going to define him and bring him back to those glory days of what everybody expected him and expects him to play at. Just allow the game to unfold. Let the season unfold. He'll ultimately get his just due. But you think about how ownership did him. You think about his situation, him being an MVP of the league at one point in time and to not get signed so late, going into the season, it just blows my mind when you have guys like Jay Cutler that don't even know the color of his team, has led the league in interceptions, be retired for a year, then come out of retirement and the Miami Dolphins go give him a job with ease. This is some of the stuff that blows my mind. You have a guy in Jason Witten that was in the booth that comes out of the booth and the Cowboys give him a job with ease. Like he was not a factor at all. But they gave him a job, gave him an extension, gave him a contract. But you have an MVP, a black guy, black quarterback of the league at one point in time, regardless, injuries or not. This guy is a very capable quarterback, football player in the National Football League. And I like his mindset because he took that at disrespect.
As my last question for you, OG, when I look at the game and when I look at you as an athlete, a Hall of Famer in one sport, but I know you got a love of playing another sport. Do you think, well, first of all, like, who do you compare yourself to in the basketball world? Because I know you itching to get on the court. I remember when I was with the Clippers, and you used to always be on the side over there, like, getting ready to get on the court. So who do you compare yourself to?
Oh, man, this is funny. I see myself as sort of like a tweener. I can play above the rim. I didn't have the handles as I would like. But I think of a guy like a Scottie Pippen. You know what I mean? Very athletic, can play in transition, can play defense. I can hit the J if need be. I've always kind of said that my game is kind of like his. Not as long as he is, but I just like the way he plays on both ends. He can play offensively, defensively, he plays in transition, runs the floor well. He's just one of those valuable pieces to a team. So, again, that's just how I am. If I'm playing pickup ball, I'm always going to try to add some value. No matter if it's a pickup game, it's a celebrity game, it doesn't matter. I'm going to try to add some value. Or if it's just pickup and I know I'm like one of the top players, then I'm going to take over the game if need be. But if I know I got some dogs with me, we got some shooters or whatever, then I'm going to try to figure out a way to kind of contribute to the game. If that's defensively or what have you, that's what I'm going to do. But, Kobe's my guy. MJ's my guy. Bro, like I said, I wish I had a smooth stroke like a Caron Butler or Steph Curry. Like, oh, yeah, trust me, bro. I watch, trust me. You know, JP is my guy, the head trainer for Los Angeles Clippers. We've been knowing each other since 96, which is a surprise to a lot of people that have come through that organization. Jason, like I said, we just like this. I've given him some of my touchdown balls. Some of my first touchdown balls too early on in my career. That's how much he means and how much he meant to me and our friendship. So I'm always going down to the Clippers organization. I mean, I've seen so many guys, you know, come in and out of there, and a lot of people that walk into his office and they see that football in there, they're blown away at the stories that I'm sure he shares with them about, you know, our friendship. And the fact that I have a love and an affection and a passion to play basketball. Because honestly, like I said, basketball, that helped me on the football court. I mean, on the football field. When you talk about hand-eye coordination, all those things, being agile, stop and go, change of direction, things of that nature. Basketball offers all of that. And those things transition transition to football very, very well. And that's what enabled me to kind of do a lot of the things that I did on the football field.
Hey, would you play in the Big Three if offered? Like, would you play on that setting?
Yeah, you know, I mean, everybody had been trying to get me on there the last probably like 2 or 3 years ago. A lot of people had reached out to Cube. I had talked to him, and I think they've changed the rules now, but prior to that, it was NBA-sanctioned guys. They either had to have some years – overseas experience or definitely NBA experience or what have you, but I would love to play it, man. Like I said, I love basketball. Trust me, I went to some of those games. There's a lot of physicality that's being played, and it's like some street ball with some with a little touch of NBA in there.
Hey, T.O., man, once again, bro, thank you for coming on my platform and sharing this platform with me. It's been a pleasure and honor. You know, somebody that I watched for years from afar, and bro, this meant everything, man. I appreciate your time, making time even when I know you didn't have time, bro. Appreciate
it. Oh, man, it's all good, man. Like I said, man, it was, bro, Nothing to it. Like I said, we've run across each other, man. I admired your career. I've watched basketball. Trust me, like I said, this is right, man. For me, this right here is, man, is what we're trying to do really in the Black community. It's really just help each other out. You know what I mean? This is a version of supporting Black business, because that's what we are. We're an entity. We're our own business. We're out here really trying to share our knowledge and our experiences with those that are coming up, you know, beyond us. And so, like I said, it was nothing but a pleasure to be on the show, man. I appreciate you. If you need me to come back on, just let me know, man. I'm here for you.
Likewise, brother. Thank you, King.
No doubt.